Hi, I'm Jenna from Coconut Grove, and you're listening to the South Florida Roundup. Now, here's Tom Hudson.
Great to hear from you, Jenna. Thanks so much for helping us out, and welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup this week.
One of the promises I made was that I would be the most pro-Israel governor in America.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis speaking this week at the Kol Ami Emanuel Synagogue in Plantation. He announced plans to hold next month's Florida cabinet meeting in Israel.
I think it's really an unprecedented effort to strengthen the ties between Florida and the state of Israel, and the bedrock of the relationship is shared values.
DeSantis said the trip's main purpose is to promote investment in Florida, partnerships in areas like the environment, also on the agenda. So this is where we'll begin this week with the South Florida Roundup. What do you think about state lawmakers doing business in Israel next month? You can join the conversation. Send us a text. Here's the text line, 786-786-7636. Just give us your first name, please, where you're texting from in South Florida or outside of South Florida, for that matter, if you're listening online. The text number working across the globe at 786-786-7636. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. WLRN's Danny Rivero is along with us. Miami Herald's politics reporter David Smiley is with us from our studios inside the Miami Herald's newsroom in Doral. And from the NPR studios in New York City is Emma Green, a writer for The Atlantic magazine. To all three of you, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Danny, let me start here. What do we know about this cabinet meeting that's going to be held 6,000 miles away from the state of Florida?
So we do know that this meeting is going to be held in the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Not too many details are known. I don't have a full list of who's going, but there will be a delegation coming from here, and apparently including members of the cabinet. The consul general for the Israeli consulate here in Miami will be joining that. Basically, this is going to be a public meeting, according to what Governor DeSantis has said. It does present some questions about how a meeting can be conducted in a foreign country and still abide by Florida's notoriously strong open meetings and open records
laws. I was just going to ask you, there's robust open meetings laws, sunshine laws in the state of Florida. We're known for that across the country, certainly. So is this going to be able to comply with those laws?
So I actually asked Barbara Peterson, the president of the Florida First Amendment Foundation, about this, and she told me that she believes that they would be able to comply with existing open meetings laws if they video stream it.
Okay.
There's a section of Florida law that allows for video conferencing. For instance, if a cabinet member is out of town, they're not accessible, they can kind of wire into it. It's never been done, as far as what I know, out of the country. An additional wrinkle in this is, you know, every country has discretion to allow who they want to enter their country. Israel has, you know, in undocumented cases, denied entry to people of Palestinian descent, of coming in, people from different Arab backgrounds, including some U.S. passport holding Jewish people who support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to kind of encourage a change in Israeli policy in occupied territories in the West Bank.
So if a Floridian wanted to go to this meeting in Jerusalem and wanted to perhaps take part publicly, they could run the risk potentially of the inability to get into Israel.
Theoretically, there's in Israel, they have a law that says, you know, if you support anti-BDS, we don't have to let you into the country. And there's been at least one case I know where they did at the beginning deny entry to an American Jew for supporting those anti-BDS laws.
David Smiley, let me bring you in here. You covered the gubernatorial candidate, Ron DeSantis, who courted pro-Israeli voters, certainly in Florida. What do you make of this pledge, this plan that he announced this week about bringing a cabinet meeting into Jerusalem?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, DeSantis, on one hand, making good on a campaign promise. I mean, he said he was going to do this, and he's doing it. So good for him on that front. But, you know, I think it's also him solidifying his ideology, his relationship with the Jewish community, particularly the conservative Jewish community. There has, I think, for the last 20 years, going back to the rise of the Likud party and, you know, after 9/11, been a closer ideological alignment between the Republican Party in the U.S. and the Israeli political elite. And so I think what you're seeing in him stressing that relationship and making really strong efforts to, you know, to, reach out to people in Israel and to continue to talk about it, you know, including going after Airbnb and their policy mm-hmm. over, you know, which they just recently reversed over not listing homes in West Bank settlements. You know, that's part, I think part of it is politics and part of it is ideology.
We'll unpack a lot of that, certainly with the business relationship with Airbnb and the leverage that the governor is trying to utilize in terms of its business practices in Israel, and of course the clear interest, financial interest, that Airbnb and its hosts have with its business here in Florida, where we have more than 100 million tourists a year. Let me bring in Emma Green, who is a reporter with The Atlantic magazine, with us from New York. Emma, you cover Israel and the region for The Atlantic. What about this interest from essentially what are local politicians in Mideast affairs?
You know, I was stationed in Israel for The Atlantic for about a year, and one of the things that struck me was the constant stream of pictures of politicians from as high as the President of the United States to as lowly as the mayor of certain towns, people who are part of state assemblies and legislatures, constantly going through the country, meeting with high-level officials, and demonstrating what effectively amounts to their support for the state of Israel. I think there's this strong desire among American politicians to show constituents that they are part of this strong alliance between Israel and the United States.
And how much of that is symbolic? How much of it is really tangible in terms of a mayor, or for this matter in the state of Florida, a governor? Yes, the third most populous state in the United States, but really, you know, exerting kind of any influence when it comes to foreign policy in the U.S. between Washington and now Jerusalem.
Obviously, it's much more meaningful when you're talking about national legislators in Congress, obviously the White House. But I do think there's some sort of value from a policy level and a political signaling level when you're talking about those local and state level representatives and politicians. They may be effectively saying to their constituents, we know that Israel, which has become this divisive issue and ultimately a marker issue of identity in American politics, we know that you care about this and we care about it too. We're with you and you can count on us to be aligned with you, even if in our level of government, we don't have direct power over, for example, the defense budget or the foreign aid budget.
Yeah. Local state politics in play with Mideast policy. That's what we're talking about here on the South Florida Roundup. That's Emma Green with The Atlantic magazine. David Smiley covering politics with our partner, the Miami Herald. Danny Rivera with us at WLRN. And you as well, you can send us a text, 786-786-7636. There are the number, 786-786-7636. What do you make of Governor Ron DeSantis fulfilling a campaign pledge to bring a Florida cabinet meeting to Israel? He made and announced those plans this week. What about the politics of the right in Florida, the politics of the right in the United States, and the politics of the right in Israel, and Israeli politics for that matter this week, and how that comes to play in the state of Florida? All that is still to come as the South Florida Roundup, the special pledge edition, continues after this.
This is Cindy Bari, and you're listening to the South Florida Roundup with Tom Hudson.
Thanks, Sandy. Appreciate you helping us out on this special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. Continuing our conversation on the ties between Israel and Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis announcing this week he plans to hold the next Florida cabinet meeting in Israel next month, making good on a promise that he made on the campaign trail this past fall. During his visit to South Florida this week, the governor also reiterated his push against companies like Airbnb. Airbnb announced this week it had reversed its ban on listings of Israeli settlements in the West Bank for rental. It had removed those listings to protest the treatment of Palestinians there.
Airbnb wants to go public, if they go public, the state of Florida ain't investing in them. That's a big problem if you want to go public.
So the leverage of politics and money when it comes to Mideast relationships between the Sunshine State and Israel. What do you think about this relationship? You can send us a text. The text line is open. Please send us your name and where you're texting from. Here's the number, 786-786-7636. 786-786-7636. With us is WLRN's Danny Rivero, the Miami Herald's politics reporter, David Smiley. And also with us is Emma Green, a writer for The Atlantic. She wrote a piece this week entitled, What Another Round of Netanyahu Will Mean for American Jews. We'll have a link to that story at WLRN.org. I want to talk about the election in Israel coming up in just a moment, Emma. But first, Danny, walk us through this Airbnb controversy in the West Bank and how it relates to Florida.
So basically, Airbnb decided as a matter of policy, it was getting pushback because there are Israeli Jewish settlements in the West Bank. And the West Bank has been occupied by the Israeli army or controlled by the Israeli army since the war in 1967. Mm-hmm. Within that, there are several Jewish settlements that Arabs, Palestinians around, are generally not allowed to access. Those are kind of outposts within mm-hmm. this occupied territory. And what happened was is there are Airbnb postings in those territories. And these are generally, on a worldwide level, regarded as illegal outpostings, that these settlements are illegal. And so Airbnb took the position that they were going to stop listing those
right.
because those were listed at illegal settlements. Our governor Ron DeSantis, he ran on the platform of being what he called as the most pro-Israel mm-hmm. governor in the country. He came into office, and just a couple days after he came in, he said, "Listen, I take issue with this,
yeah.
and Florida, we're gonna seek to do what we can do. We won't invest with them if they have an IPO. We're gonna, right. you know, look into
pension funds won't be able to invest in it. State employees cannot stay at Airbnb locations, for instance, that kind of thing."
Exactly. Yeah. So he really pushed that. Obviously, that's changed a little bit this week. The company did reverse their position, mm-hmm. so now it's pretty much moot. But that's where this whole thing started.
Emma, what are your thoughts about how all of this played out as you've reported in Israel? You've looked at this situation in a much larger scope than just through the lens of Florida.
Well, not only did we see a pushback from American Jews and American politicians on that Airbnb decision and other BDS-style decisions from companies, we've actually seen the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now going to probably reform a new governing coalition for another term in Israel. He promised just before the election that he was going to begin the annexation of the West mm-hmm. Bank. So not only do we see sort of this backlash from the U.S. perspective against BDS, but we actually see Israel and its leaders, its political elite, moving forward with this full vision of annexation, this idea that all of the West Bank should actually eventually come to be part of Israel.
And David Smiley, perhaps more at stake for Governor DeSantis is less about the power of the purse and the potential of not having the Florida pension system invest in Airbnb should it decide to go public, but just the pulpit upon which the governor has been able to talk about this issue, right?
Yeah, there's a constituency here for him in Florida that's really important. In this state, top of ticket races are decided by really slim margins,
yeah.
and he beat Andrew Gillum by a little more than 30,000 votes. The chairman of his Jewish outreach effort, DeSantis's Jewish outreach effort, suggested after the election that it was DeSantis's performance with Jewish Floridians that actually made up that gap. I think you can make a lot of different arguments in the margins, but I think the point is that he did better than with Jewish voters than Rick Scott did, for instance, according to exit polls, or you could say Andrew Gillum did worse than Bill Nelson. And so in terms of politically, you know, in a state where decisions are so close, it is good for him to continue to have a good relationship with Jewish voters who, by and large, tend to vote Democratic.
Yeah. Emma, help us out with some of the politics domestically and the politics within Israel and kind of how the right is different when it comes to that type of political supporter and the kind of courting that we're seeing that we saw with Governor DeSantis and potentially could see in the future?
You know, we're at this generational moment in American Jewish politics where the American Jewish population, which is by and large very liberal, meaning that they overwhelmingly vote for Democrats in the United States, are becoming much more fractured over this issue of Israel, which historically has been a uniting issue. You have seen traditionally Jews who are solidly Democratic in terms of their domestic policy, but who on this particular issue really tend to identify with that pro-Israel, sometimes more typically Republican stance on strong defense aid for Israel. And you see those Jewish voters being caught somewhat in the middle by the political situation in the U.S. and in Israel. They may be not that comfortable with President Donald Trump, some of his comments about white nationalism, and they may not identify with some of the policies that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has enabled, either in terms of security or in terms of the quashing of religious pluralism.
So what does the re-election of Prime Minister Netanyahu mean for American Jews? We saw that election this week.
I think we're going to continue to see this fracturing of the American Jewish population. You have, on the one hand, a very strongly pro-Israel, determinedly right-wing population in the U.S., tends to be more religious and orthodox. You have those middle voters that I was speaking about who feel somewhat caught in this political moment. But you also have, especially among millennials and younger Jews, this growing segment of the population that is skeptical of Israel, that openly identifies with BDS, or at the very least, doesn't like what they see as Israel's occupation of the West Bank. And that pulling apart of the American Jewish population on this Israel is only on this issue is only going to continue to make this more and more controversial in the coming years.
And David Smiley, how does this set up then for Florida in play in 2020? Where we don't have a governor's race, we don't have a U.S. Senate race, but clearly Florida is going to be squarely in the eyes of both President Trump aiming for a re-election as well as the Democratic presidential candidates.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're seeing a lot of things play out in this current legislative session, for instance, that are pretty clearly about 2020, including, you know, the Sanctuary Cities bill that's moving through Tallahassee. Having for the Republican Party to have the ability to go at Democrats over the issue of anti-Semitism, I think is a very useful tool for the party as Democrats politically become a little more aligned with Palestinians and Muslims and the issue of civil rights and whether that community is being discriminated against. Republicans and Donald Trump are often hit with so many allegations of intolerance and discrimination for them to be able to use anti-Semitism and the party's relationship with Israel and a currently very popular governor's relationship with Israel and Florida Jews is, I think, a really useful tool and will be once the campaign really starts heating up in Florida.
Here on the South Florida Roundup, talking about politics, talking about foreign policy as it relates to Governor Ron DeSantis and his announcement this week that he will hold a Florida cabinet meeting in Jerusalem inside the U.S. Embassy next month. Collecting your thoughts via the text machine, 786-786-7636. Some text coming in, one from 850 phone number. As a taxpayer, I resent the cost to taxpayers of flying the Florida cabinet to Israel for a symbolic gesture. Further, I think the current U.S. policy towards Israel is counterproductive to peace. Also, another comment from the 954 texter, the boondoggle and complete waste of taxpayer dollars. Another example of Governor DeSantis pandering for political gain. And then this from 786, I just want to know who's paying for the trip and where is this connection to Israel coming from? What do we know about the financial implications of lifting up the Florida cabinet from the Sunshine State, Danny, and transporting them, importing it into the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, 6,000 miles away?
Well, the short answer is we don't know. We don't know who's paying for it. We don't know how much it's going to be. We don't know what hotel they're going to be staying in Jerusalem. We don't know how long the trip is going to be. There's a lot of things we don't know. Yeah. You know, and to some of the people who sent the text-ins point, you know, once the final bill is tabulated and calculated, if something concrete doesn't come from this, there's not some big deal reached on an environmental issue. You know, Governor DeSantis said he wants to go there to talk to researchers about red tide that we're having here. If something big doesn't happen from this, and that bill runs up to a considerable tab, this will be something that someone could point out later down the road and say, look at that waste of money you guys did. You guys live in Tallahassee. Why didn't you do the meeting there?
Yeah, Danny, David, rather, what about the precedent for these kinds of foreign trips? Governor Rick Scott made several foreign trips in his time in Tallahassee, but they were always, well, I shouldn't say always, but they were particularly economically focused. It was three things that Governor Scott was after on these trips, right? It was jobs, jobs, and jobs. Are we seeing that same? We're not necessarily seeing that same kind of lens here with Governor DeSantis in this Israeli trip.
Well, ostensibly it's a trade mission, right? I mean, yeah. that's how he announced it. I think the cabinet meeting maybe is clouding a little bit of that, and perhaps some skepticism over like, well, what kind of trade are you really bringing back from the Middle East? But I mean, as you mentioned, this isn't the first time that a governor's gone overseas, and I really think the evaluation of whether this is worth it or just a, you know, political stunt or a dog and pony show is going to be made after the fact, whether he comes back with anything to show for his efforts and the expense of it.
The governor, DeSantis, has talked about Israel's successful water industry, for instance. There's a significant and deep biotechnology industry in Israel. There's a small biotechnology industry here in South Florida. I mean, David, what are the opportunities for the trade mission between Florida and Israel?
I don't want to punt on this, but I kind of have to. I'm not the expert on that. So I
fair enough.
I would hope someone will bail me out.
One thing I can add is Israel's very advanced with desalination technology. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, sea level rise happens, our aquifers are kind of threatened by saltwater intrusion. They have a lot of technology that Florida could potentially use to secure our you know, the fact that we have water for the years to come.
Water security. Emma, how about from your vantage point, what do you think Israel could offer Florida in terms of economic power?
I certainly think there are a lot of potential gains from that cross-pollination between the two countries. You see this startup nation reputation that Israel has with all of its technology industry. As you mentioned, there's all of this agricultural innovation because, as it turns out, Israel is just essentially this patch of dry desert that has magically become verdant over the last 50 and 60 years. So there is a lot of cross-cultural exchange, but ultimately I think there's politics at play here. It's all about the symbolism. It's all about signaling, and it's all about trying to demonstrate to voters where government officials lie.
Yeah. Emma Green, reporter with The Atlantic Magazine. Emma, thanks for sharing your reporting and your expertise with us here on the South Florida Round. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Smiley, always great to have you. Thanks for popping in from the newsroom over in Doral.
My pleasure.
And Danny Rivero, you stay close. We got plenty more to talk about, including three South Florida congresswomen denied entry to a homestead shelter for migrant children this week. Is it legal? It's coming up as the South Florida Roundup continues after this.
I'm Diana Hernandez-Allende in Miami, and you're listening to the South Florida Roundup with Tom Hudson.
Diana, thanks so much for your help. Thanks for supporting WLRN and the South Florida Roundup. We are going to talk now about the Child Detention Center that is in operation in South Florida. Three South Florida congresswomen, Donna Shalala, Debbie Mercosal-Powell, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, were denied entry into that homestead shelter. It is for migrant children. They wanted to inspect the facility after the Trump administration recently announced that it plans to increase the capacity, more than double the capacity of the shelter. It would be the second time this year it's been increased. Mercosal-Powell represents the district where the shelter is located.
Instead of adding beds, they should be reducing. They need to be focusing on the resources that they need in order to reunify these kids with family members. Many of these children have been there between 3 to 6 months.
The South Florida lawmakers say denying them entry into the shelter is illegal. Your thoughts on the Homestead Child Migrant Detention Center, 786-786-7636. Perhaps you've driven past it. Perhaps you've seen it. Your questions about it on the text line. Text us your questions, 786-786-7636. Please text us your name and where you are texting from. WLRN's Danny Rivero is still with us here in studio, and Monique Madden is with us. She is a reporter with our partner, the Miami Herald. Monique with us from our studios inside the Herald in Doral. Monique, you were at the shelter when the trio of representatives were there this week, not allowed entry. What was that situation like? Paint us the picture. I mean, did they just walk up to the front door and they were barred from going in?
Sure. It's very interesting. So they got into they got off of their car and went straight to the armed guard that was at the front of the facility. And that is typical. I have toured the shelter myself. So what you do is you go up to this guard who is armed and you say, I'm here to see X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And then they walk you over. Well, what happened was is that the armed guard said, I'm sorry, you're not allowed in. It was almost as if the security was prepared to not accept the congresswomen in. So what happened at that point is that one of the congresswomen took out their cell phones, mm-hmm. and decided to recite the law that was recently passed. And as she was doing that, the security guard said, well, I'm going to walk you over to the shelter director and then we'll go from there. So what happened is that they walked all across the property into this small little building. They spent about 5 minutes in there and they came back out and held a press conference saying that they were not allowed in.
The law that they recited was a recently approved measure that essentially states that congresspeople cannot be denied entry into this type of facility, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And so was their presence at the shelter anticipated? Had the security guard or had security been alerted that they were coming?
I believe so. I myself wrote a story advancing that. Mm-hmm. It did make headlines. So, yes, I believe they were prepared and there were advocates outside and protesters.
Yeah, all they had to do was be a subscriber to the Miami Herald and they would have known that
there
it was happening, right? You mentioned you've been inside that shelter. Danny Rivero, I know that you visited this shelter as well. Describe it. What does it look like?
It looks like it's how do you describe it? It looks like a camp in some parts. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's playing fields for kids to play soccer. I haven't actually been inside the camp.
Yeah.
I'll state that. So I'll defer to Monique for the inside of it.
Chain link fences around
the
gate.
Some parts of the property do have chain linked fences. The other parts are just regular fencing. There is a tiny little moat around parts of the property as well. Yeah. As far as inside the shelter, you have parts of it that used to be the old Job Corps site. So they're actually concrete buildings. Some other parts of the property are white tents, AC tents, of course. You walk in, it's almost like going into, I don't know, you said camps. So that is correct. There are playing fields. There's a cafeteria. So parts of it does look like a high school almost or a middle school where you have a property where, you know, they stand in line. And also you have portable bathrooms and portable showers. Mm-hmm. If you walk in, you'll see the kids always color-coded and walking in single file lines.
And you mentioned the kids. This is a child detention center, Danny. This and the inhabitants, those that are being detained here, are a result of the family separation policy at the U.S. border, correct?
Some of them.
Yes.
Some of them. I don't believe all of them. Some of them are unaccompanied minors that arrived.
Haven't been separated because they came across the border without a parent or guardian.
Well, I do want to jump in there.
Yeah.
That's what HHS is saying, but we have found
Health
that,
and Human Services, which
yes.
is responsible ultimately once they come into the country and are detained.
There are a few details. So if you cross the border with, let's say, a sibling or an aunt or an uncle or even a step parent, someone who is not your biological mother or father, that you're still considered unaccompanied, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
So that's a discrepancy that we've reached out to HHS about. We've asked some questions. We're still waiting to hear back to get the population numbers. So, yes, some of those kids are unaccompanied minors by definition, but others are not.
And just to add to that, I have talked to Congresswoman Shalala, who told me, you know, maybe this is something that statutorily they need to clarify, like what is an unaccompanied minor? Hmm. If you arrive with someone who might be a loved one, someone that you're under their custody, but you're not a blood relative, if there's some kind of a way that can be legislated to kind of clarify that, because that is a little bit confusing.
Louisa senses a text. These shelters, I believe, are privately held. Monique, is this privately run shelter?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is a temporary influx facility. It is privately run by a third-party company, a company that gets a contract by the government. So, yes, it is. It's not subject to public record the way other shelters would be.
And there is this expansion plan that was announced just a few weeks ago that would double the number of kids and teenagers that could be held here, right?
Yes, absolutely. So there are several people who have camped out of the shelter for several months now, and they have reported seeing beds being taken in and new structures being placed.
These are observers who've camped out, is
yes.
what you're saying? I see advocates, for instance, that are interested in this policy and obviously interested in this detention center.
Exactly.
Yeah. Danny, what about other tours, other visitors, other public officials that have visited this? This has become obviously a bit of a focal point in the immigration debate we're seeing nationally.
Absolutely, it has been. I've been down there a couple times talking to Congress people as they have arrived. One time Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman, and former Senator Bill Nelson went, and they were denied admission, and that was back in September, I believe.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's been kind of ongoing. And just a couple months ago, there was a small delegation from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus mm-hmm. that went, and they actually did get a tour. They did it beforehand. And some of the Congress members came out, and Representative Mucarcel Powell came out. She said, you know, this is very prison-like. I talked to Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas, mm-hmm. who's the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. He said, you know, this is prison-like. These children are basically being forced into this, and we need to find a way out of it. He called for the facility to basically be shut down.
Yeah.
He played a pretty big role in the shutdown of a similar facility, which was not for profit, that was being run out of Tornillo, Texas. He said, you know, a similar outcome should happen here in Homestead.
Monique, what's the future for these visitors? Will the congresswoman come back? Will they be let in?
That's a good question. I'm currently talking to their offices to see what the next steps are, but I know that they had said they will be planning on doing some sort of legal action. They have been totally unclear about what that means.
Yeah, who would be the counterparty here? Would
exactly.
it be the private company? Would it be the security company, the federal government?
Totally a mystery, totally okay. up in the air. But as far as next steps and the future of the facility, I'm not completely sure, but they're, the Congress people are looking into visiting.
That's what we do. Ask a lot of questions, try to find those answers. Monique Madden, thanks for sharing your reporting with us from
Thank
the
you.
Miami Herald. Always
Thank
great
you.
To have you. And Danny, wonderful to have you on the South Florida Roundup as well. Danny Rivera, reporter for us here at WLRN. It's our special pledge edition here on the South Florida Roundup. As always, we thank you for your support. Finally on the Roundup this week, paying tribute to the least poetic definition of where you live. It's an ode to your zip code. WLRN has partnered with the O Miami Poetry Festival again this month of April, National Poetry Month, asking you to write a poem about where you live. You can use your 5-digit zip code as a guide. It's called a zip ode. It's a 5-line poem using your zip code. Each digit represents how many words per line.
I'm Christina. I live in Miami Shores, and my zip code is 33138. Cars speed down these residential streets. Neighbors post complaints in the neighborhood's Facebook group. Really, which is worse?
Hello, my name is Leilani. I live in Hialeah, Miami. My zip code is 33012, and my zip code goes like this. Hialeah's too much. I should know. ... I am too.
The lake view is very relaxing, except when you have to share your wine with ferocious and predatory disease-carrying Doral mosquitoes. My name is Diana Eastep. I live in Doral, 33178.
Hola, todos. My name is Hillary Caxer. I've lived here on and off, and currently I live on Miami Beach, where my zip code is 33140. What do you do with the zero? Well, WLRN said to make it a surprise, so hopefully I can surprise you. Here's my zip code. My zip-ode. The shorebirds strut and squawk, and so do the people. Miami! Muchísimas gracias. Ciao!
You can write your own Zipode by using the online tool that we've created. You can find it at wlrn.org/zipodes. Now, the deadline to submit your Zipode is April 19th. And that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. We thought we would get some help in telling you who helped create our program.
I'm Patricia Carlin in Doral. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez.
This is Ryan Wilson in West Palm Beach. WLRN's engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is the digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard.
I'm Erin from Homestead. Alicia Zuckerman is WLRN's editorial director. WLRN's program director and the show's technical supervisor is Jason Zabka.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting WLRN. Have a great weekend.